This is a CBC podcast. Hey, kids, enter the TD Kids Book Club contest, and you could win a visit to your school from one of the TD Canadian Children's Literature Award nominees. And CBC Radio will be there to put it on the air. Visit cbc.ca/kidsbookclub for details. Contest only in selected cities.
Hello, and welcome to part three of the current podcast. I'm Jan Wong.
Tell me, is there some society you know that doesn't run on greed? You think Russia doesn't run on greed? You think China doesn't run on greed? Of course, none of us are greedy. It's only the other fellow who's greedy. The world runs on individuals pursuing their separate interests.
That's legendary economist Milton Friedman at the height of his powers in 1979. And the idea that self-interest, greed, and even a little ruthlessness will get you ahead is still a powerful one. But according to Franz De Waal, when you look at human beings as a species, the warm and fuzzy stuff matters. A lot. Franz De Waal is one of the world's leading primatologists. He's known for his groundbreaking research on what humans can learn from the power games played by chimpanzees. And now he has turned his attention to the role that empathy plays in animal and human survival. Franz De Waal's latest book is The Age of Empathy, Nature's Lessons for a Kinder Society. And he's in Toronto. Good morning.
Good morning.
You write that the study of empathy hasn't been taken very seriously until recently. Why do you think it's necessary to take it seriously now?
Oh, I think it has been neglected because it was considered a soft topic, more for women's magazines or that kind of things. And now there's an enormous interest both in animal behavior, human neuroscience. And I think it is very important because it is what connects us. If we had no empathy, there would be no connection between people. Why would you care about anybody else? You would just care about yourself.
At what point did you become interested in this?
Well, I started working with apes and monkeys long ago, and I saw that they sometimes, after fights, in chimpanzees, for example, that the victim of a fight of aggression would be consoled by others. Others would surround it and put an arm around it. And I found it a very interesting behavior, but had no good name for it. I called it consolation until I ran into some psychologists who studied this exact same thing in children and said, well, we call that sympathy. And so that's where it clicked for me, is that my chimps were exactly showing that kind of behavior.
You witnessed a really brutal killing at the Arnhem Zoo. Is that right? Can you talk about it, about a chimpanzee?
Yeah, that was a. I started my studies actually not with empathy or cooperation. I started it with politics and power politics among males. And in chimpanzees, that's a very vicious affair. And yes, when the things are stable among them, they are friendly and cooperative and they get along fine. But as soon as one male starts to challenge a bunch of others, it becomes very nasty. And in this particular case, a male got killed by a coalition of two other males. And I was standing next to the veterinarian who was trying to save the life of that one male who was so viciously bitten and beaten by the other two. That at that moment, it sort of clicked for me that all these things that I had seen of consolation and reconciliation and cooperation, that they were extremely important, and that if they fall apart somehow, then you get the kind of killings. And so I became interested in the opposite of the aggression topic that was then the topic for everybody. I became interested in how a society hangs together.
You noticed special behavior in the bonobos and other chimps. Can you describe that kind of empathy behavior? What do they do?
Yeah, bonobos are special. Bonobos are just equally close to us as chimpanzees. And people know much less about bonobos. Bonobos do everything that chimps do with, let's say, grooming and embracing. The bonobos do with sex. And that makes them a bit spectacular in the eyes of some people. But basically, it has the same function. It's like after a fight, you need to make up. If someone is distressed, you need to reassure that individual. And whether you do that with sex, as the bonobos do, or with a kiss and embrace, or grooming, as the chimps do, it doesn't actually matter that much, because all of them have mechanisms to keep things under control.
Can you elaborate on the sex stuff? I'm sure
you want more sex.
Yeah, more sex. What do you mean when you say they do the sex thing?
So bonobos have sex in all combinations of individuals, so not just male female, and they have sex in all positions that you can imagine, and even in some positions that people will find very hard to imagine, I suppose, because they cannot do it hanging upside down and all of that.
Okay.
So they have an extremely varied sex life. That they use at the drop of a hat, basically. So and in public, and that's a big difference with humans. Humans use sex also, of course, to make up and for all sorts of social purposes, but usually not in public. It's not in the middle of the street.
You haven't been hanging around some high school. No, but you say they use it. Tell me the circumstances that they would use sex to change a situation or something like that.
So, for example, there's a fight between two females, let's say, over food. Or over a child that has done something wrong, and then they may bite each other. So it's not like bonobos are completely peaceful. They do have aggression on occasion, but immediately afterwards there will be what is called GG rubbing. They will be rubbing their genitals together, and then they groom each other, and that's the end of it. So these things happen very quickly. And if you haven't seen the beginning, you may think just that they're having sex, but actually they're having sex for a reason, which is to resolve a conflict between them.
So do you think it's similar to the kind of feeling humans have when they empathize? Is it very human, their behavior?
Well, empathy is something else than reconciliation. Reconciliation is to make up after a fight, and so you repair a relationship. And there's actually good selfish reasons to do that, which is usually that you need the relationship. So, for example, if these two females often work together and supervise each other's babies or things like that, they need each other, and so they have good reason. Empathy is different, because empathy is a response to the need of somebody else and the situation of somebody else, where you often don't get anything out of it. So there's not necessarily a self-interest. Sometimes there is, but most of the time it's very hard to detect that. And so empathy is more that you react to the emotional state of somebody else, usually by adopting that state yourself. So let's say you're talking with someone who is frowning and crying, you're going to be frowning and crying. You talk to someone who's laughing and smiling, you're going to be laughing and smiling. And so we adopt not only in our facial expressions, we adopt the same behavior, but we also adopt the same mood. And that's called emotional contagion. And emotional contagion is the basis of everything. And if you don't have that, you cannot get to empathy. And so perspective taking, which people often take as the core of empathy, is like, I can imagine your situation, is not sufficient. I need to be affected by your situation emotionally. And that's the core. And that core, I think, is present in many animals, not just in my apes, even though it's more prominent, but also in dogs and cats and mice and whatever sort of animals.
Frans de Waal, let's talk about the evidence for that. How do you know that the animal is feeling this empathy?
I don't know what they feel, because I cannot...
If it's not just instinct.
Well, in humans also, I think empathy is an instinct, probably. It's an inborn characteristic that we have on day one. And on day one, what babies do is they start crying when they hear another baby cry, so they're emotionally affected by somebody else. So yes, it is an instinct, but I cannot know what animals feel, but I can see how they react. And so if, for example, a dog reacts to its owner because the owner is crying or has been in an accident and he hangs around the owner and licks him and whatever, I can measure behavior. I cannot ask the dog, what do you feel? And that's, of course, a big constraint. On the other hand, I should argue also that humans may tell you what they feel, but I don't trust humans particularly. I'm sort of happy that I'm working with animals who cannot fill out questionnaires, because humans tell you all sorts of stories, and they may say that they are empathic, and they may say that they feel, but I still would want to measure the actions that they perform.
You write that concern for others begins with the self. What do you mean by that?
Well, at first, of course, what happens is that you're affected by the emotion of somebody else, and so you feel that emotion within yourself. And if that's where you stay, and actually very young children under the age of 2, that's where they are with their empathy, it may disturb you. So let's say you're in distress, you start crying, I'm a very young child, I'm emotionally affected, I become sad. What do young children do? Very often they run away. They run to their parent. They don't try to console you or reassure you. They're so emotionally affected that they cannot separate where it comes from. Now, it's when they're older, and the same is true for some animals like chimpanzees and dolphins and so on, when they're more developed mentally, they can draw the distinction. They are emotionally affected by your crying, but they also know it comes from you, not from themselves, and they're going to try to do something about it. And usually we call that sympathy. So empathy is that you're affected by somebody else and that you try to understand maybe what is going on with somebody else. Sympathy is the motive that you want to do something about it. And you are distressed and I want to help you or see if I can help you and so on.
And how self-aware are bigger-brained animals, like elephants? Because he did studies on that.
We do studies on elephant empathy. And so, for example, in Thailand, we do studies of what happens when a young elephant meets a snake and freaks out. And often it is immediately surrounded by adults who start rumbling and touching it until it calms down. And that's a consolation behavior, very similar to the apes. Now, elephants have such highly developed altruistic behavior, just like chimps and dolphins, that we thought they must have mirror self-recognition, which is a sign of self-awareness, because these things go together, high forms of empathy and self-awareness. And so we tested elephants actually at the Bronx Zoo in New York, where we presented them with a huge mirror, and we put a dot on their head to see if they could find that dot with the help of the mirror. And that's sort of that's called the mark test. Most animals can't. You can put a dot on your dog and put it in front of a mirror. The dog is not gonna see another dog probably there, but it's not gonna make the connection between the mirror image and something that has been put on its own head. Children do that after the age of 2. Apes do it. Dolphins can do it. And so we tested.
And yet, dogs can feel empathy even though they can't recognize themselves in the mirror.
I think there's many animals who have the basic forms of, let's say, emotional contagion, which is empathy. But they don't make that step where they draw the line between themselves and the other, which allows them to develop more complex forms of empathy, like humans have.
Okay.
And so elephants pass the mirror test. Mm-hmm. And that fits with the idea is that the complex forms of altruism that we see in them have something to do with self-awareness, which is higher in them.
Beyond human and primate empathy, there is research to suggest that even mice, as you mentioned, are able to feel for their fellow cage mates. Jeffrey Mogul is a professor of psychology. He heads up a special lab dedicated to pain research at McGill University in Montreal. He was interested in comparing levels of pain sensitivity between a mouse on its own and a mouse that is exposed to a fellow cage mate experiencing pain. I'll let him explain the results.
And long story short, what we found was that animals tested on these inflammatory pain tests in the direct presence of cage mates, that is, animals that they knew, displayed higher levels of pain behavior, essentially were more sensitive to pain than animals tested in front of strangers or tested by themselves. That is, the act of observing another mouse that was familiar to them in pain made their own pain worse. And when I say empathy, I should qualify that I'm not talking about full-blown human empathy, and I'm not talking about sympathy. What we're talking about is a rudimentary form of empathy called emotional contagion. If mice are capable of emotional contagion, that means that this lowly mammal is, you know, well on its way to developing a human-like empathy. In a sense, one can say that the rudiments of empathy are already there in this species.
Franz Doyle, you refer to this study in your book. Mm-hmm. Why do you think it's significant?
I think it's important because I've always believed that empathy must be a general mammalian characteristic that started with maternal care. And maternal care is obligatory in mammals, and there's no reason for me to believe that if it works this way, let's say with primates, that it shouldn't work with other mammals like dogs or mice or whatever you might mention. And so the mouse study is important because it showed that your sensitivity to pain increases if you have seen a fellow member also in pain. It doesn't increase when you have seen a stranger in pain, which is a very interesting bias because human empathy is also very much biased towards the in-group versus the out-group. And so human bias is not the human empathy is not a sort of universal phenomenon that you have for everyone equally. You meet it out sort of selectively to
others. Interesting, the in-group and the out-group. And maybe is that why do you think that newscasts, if somebody in your own city dies, it gets more coverage than if somebody in a town, you know, two provinces over dies?
That's a very common bias. So, for example, after the tsunami in Thailand, the Swedes were the one who gave the most money to Thailand. And that sounds very strange until you know that many of the victims were Swedes. So 500 Swedes died on the coast there. But anyway, to come back to the maternal care, I think all mammals have maternal care. And what is maternal care? Is that you respond immediately immediately to the coldness, the danger, the hunger, the distress of your offspring. And females who are not good at that, who don't respond immediately, they're going to lose their offspring. And so that, I think, also explains the gender difference in empathy. I think empathy is more developed in females than males for that particular reason, because that's the origin of it.
Now, Professor Jeffrey Mogel is about to have another paper published in the Journal of Social Neuroscience. He was interested in whether mice would approach another mouse in pain or whether it would avoid them. Here's what he found.
You would imagine that they would avoid, but in fact what we found is that female mice will approach mice that they know that are in pain. And furthermore, the more they approach those familiar mice, the less pain the mouse in pain appears to be in. That is to say, it looks like the social interactions have analgesic effects, that they were actually coming over to help, and that the helping was working.
Franz De Waal, what do you make of his findings on this?
Well, I find it interesting. In my book, I call this pre-concern. So in full-blown concerned reactions that you have in apes, for example, I think there's a certain understanding of what's going on with the other and an insightful helping often of the other. And in humans, we call that sympathetic concern or empathic concern. In other animals, like mice, I would speak of pre-concern. There's a certain attraction to individuals who are distressed. I'm not sure that they figure out completely what's going on and that they have the sort of understanding that we adult humans have or that maybe a chimp or an elephant has. I don't expect that in a mouse. But they have the attraction already, and approaching the other, as Dr. Mogel said, has a calming effect on the other. So the whole mechanism is already there, in a way, without a lot of the cognitive abilities that we bring to this task.
Well, I think that's interesting. Let me just digress for a minute into the human species. You've said that the female species of the female of any species seems to be more empathetic to varying degrees. In humans, what does this mean for politics, for the workplace, for men who become nurses? What does this mean for the world of people?
Yeah. Well, I think certainly men can become nurses, because all these gender differences that we have in human society are what we call bell-shaped curves. If you have two means that are different, like the average man has maybe less empathy than the average woman, but you're going to have a few men who have more than the average woman, and you're going to have a few women who have less empathy than the average man. So you have this overlapping sort of range, and so it does not preclude men from tasks that involve empathy. But it is going to be on average that, let's say, politicians, if they are mostly male, they're going to be having less of it. And actually in the US we had this whole debate, I don't know if you know, but Barack Obama often emphasizes empathy, and he said that we needed to have a judge on the Supreme Court with some empathy.
Right.
And this became a big issue because the Republicans then said, why do we need empathy? And so this was called the war on empathy by the Republicans, because they didn't think it was necessary. It's a sort of interesting issue, because you would say a judge needs to be blind, justice is blind, and so empathy would not come in really. But that's only true if you have a level playing field in society. But if you have a society with suppressed groups, as we surely do in the US, then empathy is an important factor, because that may make it possible to come up for certain groups.
But is there a danger in assuming that mice or animals like elephants are feeling things just because they look like they are? You say in your book that dolphins actually don't smile. They look like they're smiling. They don't have the muscles to smile.
Yeah. No, so every animal expresses itself in a particular way. And so if, for example, a chimpanzee kisses and embraces a victim of aggression and stays with it to protect it, we cannot ask the chimpanzee what they're feeling, but the behavior is completely consistent with what we would feel in terms of being protective and trying to reassure somebody. And so we can measure behavior and then deduce the internal states from it, but no one is making claims of what an elephant feels. We don't know what an elephant feels.
Are there animals that don't demonstrate empathy at all? I mean, I'm surprised to hear that mice do.
Mm-hmm.
Are there animals that have none?
Well, I would think that outside the mammals, if you're going to go to fish or reptiles, the reason we humans, what do we have in our homes? We have cats or dogs usually. Very few humans have iguanas or turtles or snakes in their home. And that is precisely because we appreciate the emotional connection that we have with cats and dogs.
But a lot of people have fish. In fact, I think those are the people that don't want a real relationship with their animals. But people do have fish.
I have tons of fish at home because I'm a big fish lover and I have big tanks. But I don't get a lot of affection from them, and I can assure you. And so I think that emotional connection, that we have that with mammals, and we can have it with birds. And birds are not as much investigated, but I bet birds have certain forms of empathy too. But mammals and birds, I think, but if you go to reptiles and to fish, not to mention snails or things like that, or octopi, I don't think you're going to find a lot of that kind of emotions.
Well, I do know some octopi. Mm-hmm. There was a study, I guess, in Robert Sapolsky's book, where an octopi got depressed and ended up dying because his show was taken away. He used to be on show at a zoo, and then they took him away, and he really felt it.
Well, yeah,
I don't know.
these animals, they do have stress hormones, and they do suffer from stress. And if you have, for example, if you have two fish in a tank, and one is very aggressive, and the other one always is shivering in a corner, that one is going to die of just stress symptoms. So I'm not saying that fish have no feelings, so to speak, but I don't think they have an empathic reaction to someone who is in need.
What about rats? Because you talk about mice having these very kind feelings of empathy, but I don't think of a rat as a very kind or empathetic animal, but am I wrong?
No, I think all mammals have automatically that they are emotionally affected by others. They react emotionally to others because they all have maternal care and they need to have that mechanism, and rats are going to have it just like the mice do.
But you talk in your book about, is it monkeys where the parents are traipsing along and they get to a section where the baby monkeys cannot cross and the baby monkeys... The parents just cross, and the baby monkeys are screaming from the banks, like, we can't do this, help us, help, and the parents just ignore them.
Yeah, so I think that's one of the most fascinating things, and in my book I try to explain that, yes, we have the empathy mechanism, which is sort of automatic in humans and in many animals, but the limits of it. It's very interesting to explore, and it's also for human society, very important, is that, yes, we have that mechanism, but we don't always apply it, and there's certain situations where you would expect, let's say, a monkey to be empathic, but it isn't. Or you would expect a human to react with empathy, but they don't. And actually, those limits are maybe the more interesting part of the story than the regular performance of it.
So that limit for humans, why are we so mean to each other if empathy is a driving force?
Well, mean to each other. I mean, if you were to tabulate in society all the encounters between humans, the vast majority, 95%, is going to be cooperative and friendly or polite and whatever. And we pay a lot of attention to those 5% that aren't.
Right. That's what we cover in the news.
but that's not the rule of the game in human society. Now, between different groups, you may get higher levels of antagonism. And so that's a big problem for a large society like ours, where we have all these groups that are sort of mingling together. Because if empathy and solidarity are in-group phenomenon, we are really challenging the human psychology by putting a multi-million people in a city like Toronto.
Right. And yet, in Toronto, people generally get along. Mm-hmm. So that's very interesting. Why would you say that the empathy, the element of empathy is stronger in Toronto than this urge to be mean to each other? Why is it working here in Canada?
Oh, I think it's working also in New York. It was just
I don't know. We think of New York as a very scary place. Okay, so if it's working in New York, why is it working?
If you would put 10 million chimpanzees in New York, you wouldn't have the city that you have there. Not just in terms of technology or whatever, but also that would be a less polite city. There would be a lot more bloodshed in the city. So I think humans have a wonderful capacity to get along even with strangers, and to show empathy and solidarity with strangers to some degree. But there are limits to it, as we all know. And that's actually the interesting part, is like where does it stop?
Are you going to look at that next?
Maybe I'm going to do that next. But
the limits of empathy.
Yeah, but it's, of course, a less a pretty topic then, because the limits of empathy are going to show you where the frictions are in society.
And finally, my last question is, ultimately, are we just empathetic for a pragmatic reason in order to survive, in order to keep us from tearing each other apart?
I think we're empathic because in the long run, this paid off in the small communities that we evolved. We didn't evolve in cities like Toronto. We evolved in communities of maybe 100, 200 people. And in that kind of original society, it paid off to show some solidarity, to hang together, to cooperate with each other, because we all survived together.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Franz DeWall is the director of the Living Link Center at the Yerkes National Primate Research Center at Emory University. His latest book is The Age of Empathy, Nature's Lessons for a Kinder Society. Well, that's all we have for this podcast. You can listen to The Current weekday mornings on CBC Radio 1 right after the 8:30 news, 9 o'clock in Newfoundland and Labrador, as well as on Sirius Satellite Radio 137. If you have any thoughts on what you are hearing on The Current, send us your comments. Visit our website at cbc.ca/thecurrent and click on Contact Us, or you can call our feedback line toll-free at 1-877-287-7366. You can also find us on Twitter at The Current CBC. And as always, our mailing address is P.O. Box 500, Station A, Toronto, M5W1E6. Thanks for listening. I'm Jan Wong.
For more on all of our CBC podcasts, head to cbc.ca/podcasting.